This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. This is the second of three interviews that I did at the American Library Association Annual Conference in New Orleans this year. And this week, it's with Jenny Rothschild, who is a collection development librarian for Arlington Public Library in Arlington, Virginia. I am here at the ALA Annual Conference. I'm actually at a hotel lobby at the Sheraton. You don't need to know that information. But I am here with Jenny Rothschild, who has not been on the show for a long time. But you were here, and you had a completely different job last time. But I want to, before we get into what you're doing now regularly, I want to talk about what we were just talking about off the air, and that is the podcast that you do at your library. So can you briefly just let us know where you work and then how this podcast came to be?
Sure. So I work with Arlington Public Library in Arlington, Virginia. There are many Arlingtons out there, so you have to specify which state you're in, which is just across the river from D.C. And we are doing a big book club read-along of War and Peace this summer. Hashtag, oh boy, Tolstoy. And it started because my friend and coworker Megan, we were talking one day at brunch, and she said that she wanted to read War and Peace over the summer, because what better way to deal with the heat of a D.C. summer than to read about a Russian winter? And she thought that sounded fun. And I am a big fan of Natasha Pierre in The Great Comet of 1812, the Broadway musical. So it's like, oh, I'll read War and Peace with you, too. That'll be fun. We'll do it together. We'll be like gym buddies, but Tolstoy buddies. And then a week later, I was like, let's Megan and Jenny this, by which I mean go completely overboard and over the top with programming. And let's live tweet our reading experience from our library Twitter accounts and invite other people to read along with us. And we looked into it. She's like, we can have a reading schedule because it's 1,400 pages and summer reading is 14 weeks long. So it's 100 pages a week, which is totally doable. We can do this. And so we brought it to our social media person to ask, like, hey, is this an okay use of our library Twitter accounts? And she was like, yes. And we've been wanting to do more with Facebook because we get the most engagement with people on Facebook. And let's do like a weekly book chat and like book discussion group on Facebook. So it's Sunday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern on Facebook on the Oh Boy Tolstoy page. If you'd like to join us, please do. And then we decided she wanted to document it. So then we do also a weekly podcast. And it's Big Book Club's Oh Boy Tolstoy. And we recorded it on Monday after the Facebook discussion. And we just kind of wrap up our thoughts on the reading we just did, things we've been noticing in conversation, interesting questions, interesting points that have come up. We are extremely lucky in that one of our former library colleagues, she doesn't work for the library anymore, but she's reading along with us, and she is Russian, so she's reading War and Peace in Russian, and she can explain a lot of stuff and add a lot of cultural context, which has been invaluable. Also, we're librarians, so we're nerds, and so if certain things stick out in the text, we'll research it, you know, and look into it and then learn things. So if you listen, you will learn that we are now all obsessed with pineapples and renting pineapples and the role of pineapples in hospitality in 19th century Russia. Also, I personally am obsessed. I didn't realize how shady Tolstoy is. Like, his characters are throwing shade left and right. You have to read the end notes because it explains all of these weird jokes they're making in German. I'm like, oh, here she refers to Bonaparte using his Corsican name, and they also call him this and this. I'm like, that's the 19th century equivalent of calling him Bonafart. Like, all these Russian aristocrats are basically walking around just calling him Bonafart, which I am here for.
Wait, you said you've gotten a lot of good input from your community. Their community really gets involved with it on the Facebook page as well, right?
Yeah, we were hoping that maybe 25 people would think this would be a fun and worthwhile way to spend their summer. And so, like, we were setting our sights really high with 25. And we have almost 200 people subscribed to the newsletter. We have, like, 40 to 50 people who are at least watching the Facebook conversation, with 20 to 30 active participants so far, which is really fun. And, you know, like, 150-plus downloads of the podcast. So people are really into it. And some people are struggling with it. And like, I don't know if I keep reading it if it weren't for you guys. And, like, me too. But, like, instead of having a gym buddy, we have a Tolstoy buddy.
So at this point, we're at the end of June. How far along are you into War and Peace?
So we are discussing part one, volume three, or part one, part three, tomorrow night. So we are 300 pages in, because we just started at the beginning of June. And luckily, Tolstoy's internal divisions match up pretty well to about 100 pages a week. If you just go like, oh, like volume one, part one, volume one, part two, like it works out really well. And he made it easy for us to figure out that way. If people are reading different editions or different translations, we don't have to worry too much about which page numbers and stuff. So that's been helpful.
So how long do you project then? Counting forward in the book, how long will the podcast go on? How long till you actually finish the book?
So we will finish the book at the beginning of September. And then after we finish the book, we're going to have an actual in real life gathering to watch one of the many movie adaptations. We're calling it the War and Peace Survivors Party.
And then do you have any plans? Do you think you'd continue it on and with a different book then? Or do you like have the book club podcast continue and just do a different book? Or have you not thought that far ahead yet?
We are thinking about it. Part of a lot of this is a pilot project to see, like, would anyone want to talk about a book with us on social media? Would anyone want to spend all summer reading the same book instead of reading a different book every month like a traditional book club? And so far, the response has been so positive. We are, you know, thinking of doing it again. We're trying to figure out what we do. Probably not until next summer, but what kind of reading we do. And we're like, do we stick with musicals and we can do like the Chernow biography of Hamilton, or we can do Les Miserables and like stick with the musicals, or do we want to like go with Middlemarch, or someone suggested Ulysses and we're like, oh, that might be.
I don't think anybody's ever finished Ulysses.
I don't know. And it's fun though because like we're not Russian literature experts, and so like with Megan and I, most of our knowledge of the Napoleonic Wars comes from Regency era romance novels. So, you know, it's taking kind of the stuffiness out of the library and the stuffiness out of Tolstoy and just reading a book and having fun with it. Because who knew Tolstoy was so shady? Oh, man. So shady. So shady.
So that all sounds really fun, but that's not really what your job is necessarily as a podcaster. maybe someday, but... So can you tell me what... The last time you were on, you were a branch manager. You were newly promoted, I think, as a branch manager. Even if it was a while ago you were on.
Yeah.
And you were in the same system. You're still in Arlington. But what change did you make, and what's your position now that you're in?
So last time I was on, I just moved from e-services librarian to a branch manager. And then I became a branch manager of a larger, busier branch. And then a little over a year ago, I made the move to collection development, which is exciting, and I'm more back on the youth side of things because I specialize in the early literacy collection, so board books, picture books, easy readers, and then what we call the weird stuff. So it is, we circulate American Girl dolls, and those are my joy and headache to take care of and handle, and we do story time kits, which is basically story time in a bag. There's, you know, six books in there on a theme, a few different story time plans depending on which age range you're going for. Action rhymes, nursery rhymes, sometimes a puppet if it's relevant, and you can just check it out and go. We also the only non-English language materials we collect for children are Spanish language materials, but we have a lot of other languages spoken in the Arlington area, but we can't support collecting in those languages for a full collection. So what we did is we created family reading kits. And they are a bag of materials with about...
This is the door we came in, right here.
8 to 12 books in a range of, like, board books up through sometimes a middle grade novel and in that language. And then we sometimes have multiple kits for different languages depending on the popularity. So we do have some materials in the languages. And we started with the most commonly spoken languages in Arlington, which raised some eyebrows because everyone's like, why do you have like two bags in Bengali and nothing in Hindi? We're like, well, because we have many more Bengali speakers than Hindi speakers in Arlington.
Right.
But we've been expanding out the languages too as it goes on. And those are extremely popular. I deal with those. And we have nature backpacks that come through the Virginia library system. And it is a backpack, literally, and it comes with a parking pass to all of the and an entrance pass to all of the Virginia state parks, which is really popular, and then like a butterfly net and like one of those bug catchers with magnifying glasses built in, and you know, a ton of field guides to various animals and insects and trees and plants in Virginia. And those are very popular, especially in the summer.
I remember when we talked last, you would, like you said, you just moved from youth services into that, and you were kind of missing working directly with the kids at that point. And because you were kind of into management and you couldn't do that. Are there parts of the branch manager job or your other public facing jobs that you miss as part of your current job?
Nope. One thing that's nice with my current job is I do 2 hours a week on the desk, and I try to do an hour of book drop and then an hour of actual desk time. And because I have a car and drive to work, I actually go around and I go to a different branch. So I get to see all over the system and just do a few hours a week and see how the different systems, like how the different branches in the system differ from the other ones, what's popular at certain branches. And so I deal with a lot of the patrons that way and get kind of the face-to-face. So that's fun, but I don't miss the other stuff too much.
Right, so you still get to keep your toe in it and still get to work with teens and kids and everything too. So.
Yeah, I keep my toe in it, and I think that's really important for people who work behind the scenes in libraries, have a little bit of time every week or on a regular basis on the front lines, just so they know what frontline staff is dealing with. If you're going to make new policies and new procedures and new workflows, you have to know what the reality on the ground is. Otherwise, your policies and procedures are crap.
So what was appealing to you about collection management that you wanted to get into that and away from the public service, public safe facing side? So I assume there was more to it than just getting away from the public.
No, and it wasn't about getting away from the public. Like, I've nothing against the public, and it wasn't like, I can't deal with public services anymore.
Right.
I'm completely burned out, which, you know, is a really legitimate feeling that a lot of us have. Like, it is so easy to burn out on public services, and I have in the past. But I've always been drawn to collection development. I used to have a book review blog back when blogs were much bigger and before I had kids. But I do review for a lot of the trade journals. I review for School Library Journal and Library Journal and Booklist right now. I reviewed for RT Reviews for a while. And I've always, you know, I've done a lot of award committees. Like, I just got off the Edwards Committee, but I also did Outstanding Books for the College Bound. I did the YELSA Award for Excellence in Nonfiction. I've done the Sybils 11 or 12 times now. And so I've always been drawn to that aspect of librarianship, and I think evaluating literature, and especially literature for children, is just a really strong point that I have. And so being able to do more of that on a daily basis was always just what appealed to me, and really looking at having like the breadth and the depth of a collection and meeting the community needs and finding those small gems that people wouldn't necessarily notice but you can find on the shelf, and also looking at, you know, merchandising and how things are laid out and how to increase CERC and looking at the data side of that stuff, which I did a lot with public services, but I was getting all the data from collection development and working closely with collection development, and I'm just doing it from the other side. And also, you know, weeding. I get to do all the weeding reports now. I'm like, weed this, weed this, weed this, weed this. And explaining the importance of weeding as an important collection maintenance tool. And I'm like, I just bought 1,000 new books, so make some room.
Well, you talked about marketing. What kind of stuff do you do with marketing? I mean, do you kind of give them information about what's circling and what's not, and they can put things on display with that, or how do you get involved with that in your current position?
So every year, my boss, the head of our collection development department, works on the turnover stats for all the different branches and the different collections within the branches and how they compare across collection and how they compare across branches. And my entire department is super nerdily excited right now because the fiscal year ends in a week, which means it's stats time, and we get to find out, and it's great, and see how everything's going. And so I do kind of see, like, what's popular, what's not popular, how things are doing, what can we do, like, on a purchasing side, and we can also look at the work with the branches and see what to do on the branch side. One of the other really fun things about my position is, in addition to my collection development stuff, I have about 10 hours a week for Reader's Advisory Special Projects, which is great because it's all the things, all the ideas we ever had that we thought would be great, but no one had the time or energy to actually do them. I now have the time and mandate to actually do them. So when I was a branch manager, I really liked shelf talkers, and I'd buy shelf talkers for my branch, and we'd get them all together and have shelf talkers, and it would be great. But no one had the time or energy to routinely come up with new ones to switch them out. And so, like, we'd just be shell talking the same book for a year and a half. And so it didn't work as well. So what I do now is I coordinate shelf talkers. And so there's actually a ticketing system. You can report a problem of I liked this book too much and write a shelf talker. But now it's across the system. So I can take all the shelf talkers from across the system, put them together, and then push them out to everyone else. So it takes a lot of the pressure off that way. And I can kind of coordinate that. And then I'm the one who can go and do all the formatting and put them together and be like, hey, we are short one mystery. Can someone read a mystery they liked recently and can write me up one? And then I work a lot with our web team. So when the shelf talkers come in, I put them in a spreadsheet. And then we also pull them. So now we have a staff picks rotating collection on our homepage. And every month we put up new staff picks. And it's going from the same staff picks. But then anyone who works at the library can participate. So we're pulling from a much broader pool of people. So that's really fun in a really great way. And we've had a lot of success with that. I also started a form-based reader's advisory service on our website. So you can fill out a form on the webpage, and a week later we will email you back a list of books we think and hope you'd like. So that's been exciting. And I get to make a ton of book lists. I make so many book lists. I highly recommend you visit Arlington County's World War One page and see dozens and dozens of book lists all about World War One. We are very into celebrating the centennial of the armistice in November, so a lot of World War One. And then I work with our graphic design department and making some of those into actual bookmarks. So that's been really fun.
It's very cool. And you mentioned earlier off the recording that you guys have a floating collection. Does that make your job any easier or harder, or does it not really affect your job much?
I made it a little different. I started in collection development, like 2 months before I went floating. So right when we were ordering the books that would come out after we went floating. And so I was kind of there to figure out like how ordering would change. Now that we're doing floating, we're not assigning a branch, and do we need as many copies of a book, and how does that change? So right now I'm looking at a lot of data where I'm actually tracking different books that came out in January and seeing how they move throughout the system, and do they move throughout the system, and are they moving because they're put on hold, or are they moving because a patron's just returning them to a different branch? And so I'm excited to see what we learn at the end of the year from that.
And are you doing that with the whole collection, or is that just with what you collect?
I'm doing that for the whole collection. So I'm telling, you know, my coworkers about their collections. What we did is we picked 3 titles that were coming in January from every collection code. So like 3 adult new fiction, 3 adult large type, 3 bilingual, 3 picture books, 3 easy readers, 3 easy nonfiction readers, like the whole thing. And so it's a lot of data to comb through, but it's one of those things. I'm like, only 5 people care about this data and what the results are, but for the 5 of us, it is so fascinating and so cool and so fun to look at.
And do you get the form you set up, do you get any like children filling that out, or is it the vast majority of that adults?
We actually, you have to be 13 or over to fill out the form. We have a little like, I say I'm 13 or over, just because we thought we'd do it for all ages. But when I was meeting with the web team, and like, you know, when it comes to collecting personal information for minors, and we're like, we could look into what we could do with legal. It's like, for now, why don't we just back off? We have other services, you know, for kids. And so we're like, if you're not 13, like, try out these stuff instead. We do, however, have parents filling out the forms for their kids. It's like the parent will fill out the form, but with their children's interest and asking for recommendations for them, which is fine and fun.
And do you do any cataloging as part of your job?
I do not. I do not. The most cataloging I do is when a book comes in and cataloging comes over and says, this got ordered as a picture book. Are you sure about that? And usually it's like, we couldn't tell from the review, so we took a guess. Knowing if we were wrong, the good, good people in cataloging would catch it. We could look at it and see.
Okay, so you just make some judgment calls sometimes of which collection it might go in or something like that.
Yeah, because sometimes it can be hard to tell from a review if it's a picture book, if it's a picture book that might be better in the J-Fiction collection because it's for older kids. Is it a picture book or is it a graphic novel? Who can tell? You know, is it an easy reader or is it a chapter book? And just sometimes you know, sometimes it's really hard to tell. And, you know, sometimes you get three different age ranges from three different review sources. So who knows? We'll order it and see what it comes in where it should go.
Well, were there, did you get to do any collection management when you were in your previous positions, or was it all always done kind of centrally by this one department?
So the collection development's always been done centrally. They've always been really, really good at taking patron suggestions. And because I'm a big romance reader, so I was like, we should get this, we should get this, we should get this, we should get this. And they almost always bought it if they could. And one of the other nice things is on the adult side of the collection, they have a committee for frontlist new fiction. And it was like the adult collection librarians and a branch manager who would rotate every year and kind of go through the list that we get from the vendors and go like, should we buy it? If we do, how many copies do we get? And that was really useful in just learning how collection development works and how they make their decisions. And then it was great when I went to go into collection development because I'm like, I don't have collection development experience, but I do have this committee experience, so I know something. Like, I know how we look at this. And, you know, so I learned about, like, oh, you have to go through and see, like, do we have this book? Like, is it a book in a series? And if so, like, how many copies do we have the last series? Do we still need that many copies? Can we drop a copy? Do we need more copies? I learned about the James Patterson set number. Like, oh, James Patterson, all right, we're just getting this many. Like, we're not even going to, like, we don't even have to look. He just has a number, we're good. Like, we know that. I did some of that. And then also, you know, weeding's a really big part of collection development, so I do like to weed. Making sure the weeding got done, seeing if anything was happening, you know, highlighting areas where it's like, hey, I know we're not weeding this section yet, but we need to. Can you send us a report of stuff to look out for weeding after I just go through and pull the gross-looking stuff?
Right, and that's sort of that transparency within the organization where branch managers get to see how the collection people talk about things and learn about things. So that's helpful, too.
Yeah, I learned so much about, you know, why certain branches get books and certain branches don't. And even, because usually it's based on size, like the big, if we get one copy, the big branch gets it. If we get two copies, this branch, then this branch. If we get three, this branch, and this branch. But then, like, sometimes, like, this really small branch that normally only gets a book, if everyone gets a book, we'd get the second copy of something because it turns out that branch really loves esoteric cookbooks. So they get the second copy of all the esoteric cookbooks because that's where it'll circ. So
is that, do you look at that kind of stuff now too, of seeing what branches are? I mean, the floating collection, I guess, makes it a little bit differently now because you can kind of request it from anywhere and get it from anywhere. But are you still seeing patterns like that of esoteric cookbooks here and people over here like biographies and people over here like gardening books? Do you still try to do it? Like, I know you're doing kid stuff, but I mean, do you still see patterns like that and send books out like that? Well, now that you're in that department.
We definitely see the patterns. They don't get sent out that much because of the way the float works. Like, it just kind of, you go down the list and everyone gets the list, but we know where they're going to settle.
Right. And that's always what the people say the benefits of a floating collection is that the books will go to where they need to go because they'll float over there. So.
And, you know, we do, not me, but one of my coworkers does a lot of work. She knows, like, she has a formula that, like, on an average number of this many adult fiction titles fit on the shelf, and you have this many shelves devoted to adult fiction, so this is the range of what your adult fiction collection should be. And she has that for all the collections, and she has the world's most beautiful spreadsheet where she has every branch and all the collections and their collection size and what it should be and what it is, and then it's color-coded. If it's blue, it's good. If it's green, it's good. If it's blue, it's low. If it's yellow, it's getting high. And if it's red, you gotta weed or send it back. And so people, and then she does a lot of like, hey, you need to, you know, 500 items need to go.
So just, she does the alert on that and basically just tells a branch you need to get rid of 500 mystery books or 500 adult fiction or whatever.
Yeah, so, and then it's like, you know, it's like, so weed it, and after we weed it, then, like, these are the titles you can send back to, you know, which branch could use them and need them. Which usually is our main branch. Our main branch is our only drought branch. So when we started floating, all of our branches, you know, like, gained a lot. And then our main location, like, just lost everything. Everything just kind of goes out from the main location to the branches. But the main branch is under a bit of construction right now. So sometimes, like, don't float anything here. We, like, it's all on temporary shelving. Just keep it for a while. You can give it back in a minute.
Well, is there anything else that was kind of unexpected about your job now that you weren't thinking you were going to be doing that you're doing now that... was maybe not in your mind when you moved over to collection development?
Excel spreadsheet design. I don't think I realized how much... There's a lot of math involved. And even with the reader's advisory stuff, like, I have to... Because a lot of these are new projects, so I have to, like, carefully track my stats to see if it's making a difference, if it's worth our time, how's it going. And so it's a lot of math. And then to make the math easier, if you have a really good spreadsheet that will do a lot of that math for you, I actually have a beautiful spreadsheet for my budget. I can put, you know, like when I ordered it, what the order number was, how much money I spent, and then which budget it came out of. Like, did it come out of picture books? Did it come out of, you know, the easy readers? Did it come out of audio? Like, which budget did it come out of? And then there's another sheet where it's like, oh, like, here's how much money you spent on this budget because of how you labeled it, and here's how much, what your budget actually is, and here's how much you spent so far, and here's how much you have left for the fiscal year. And so I can track my spending that way. It's fun.
Yeah, people don't usually get into librarianship thinking they're going to be doing a lot of math. But
yeah, my professional development goal this year was statistics. Because a lot of times it's like, I remember enough stats from college where I'm like, I could math these two numbers together and learn something really cool. But I don't know how to math them together. I just know they'd math together. And
I know Excel will do it, but I just don't know what that thing is.
So luckily we have Linda in the library, and they have some really good stats classes, especially like business stats and how to do that. So I've been taking that, and then also graphic design, because everyone's like, you need to learn to code for libraries. I've never had to code anything, but man, do I make a lot of flyers and a lot of signs. One of my new projects is a kind of a display wiki. So every month I go through, I'm like, here are like kind of like the not obvious holidays and anniversaries that are happening this month. Like, it's the moon landing. This is when they found something in Roswell, New Mexico. And so I make a sign that's been approved by public information to go on the display. And, like, I have book lists. Like, you don't have to pull from the book list, but you can also... I try to make it as easy as possible, because we've all been at that time where, like, you walk, like, oh, the display's empty. No one has the time or energy to figure out to fill it or to figure out what should fill it. So it's like, oh, you can just go here, print out the sign, give the book list to anyone to go pull something to fill it if you don't have time to, like, come up to, like, pick your own favorites for this theme. And then I'm hoping, like, it's a fairly new resource, but I'm hoping as it catches on and people use it, then also branches will send me their displays so then other ranches can use them and share the ideas and just make things easier for everyone and stop reinventing the wheel across locations.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of the work you were doing at the conference, because you're on a award committee this time, and you've been on a lot of award committees, you've said before. Can you talk about what award you were on this time and kind of just talk about the award a little bit, just because, I mean... That was an award. I knew the name of it, but I didn't know much about it. And so I just can let people know about this one award because you were on it.
Sure. So I was on the Margaret Edwards Award, which is a YELSA award. And YELSA is the teen division in ALA. And the Edwards Award is a wonderful award that looks at an author's body of work. And we choose a number of books to honor an author for. It could be all their books. It could be one book. It could be some of their books. But the distinction is all of the books have to be published at least 5 years before the committee started their work. And it is for an author and work whose work had, like, just a lasting impact and lasting meaning to teen readers. And so I spent the year reading a lot of backlist and looking at a lot of publication dates and, you know, really deep diving into a lot of really great authors, which was really interesting, and discussing them with my committee. And so at Midwinter, we announced that Angela Johnson was the winner for First Part Last, Heaven, Sweet Hereafter, Bird, Toning the Sweep, and maybe something else. I can't remember. I know definitely those books, maybe one or two others. And then it was great because she was presented with the award today and gave a speech, and we got to sit and have brunch with her and talk to her. And she is so funny, y'all. Like... You know, her prose is so just, like, lyrically spare, and her sentences are so perfectly crafted. And there's, you know, a lot of humor and heart in her books, but she's just, like, laugh-out-loud hysterical when you're talking to her, which is really fun. So that's a really great award. I love the Edwards Award. And also, it turned 30 this year. So 30 years of the Edwards. And in the June issue of School Library Journal, they did a really great work on the Edwards Award. They have some articles on it, including a profile of Angela Johnson, But they also have a really cool timeline that runs across the bottom of these articles, which milestones of the award, but also just like other milestones in YA and looking at it. So it's really interesting. If you want to know more about the Edwards Award, check out the June issue of School Library Journal. They put together a really nice package for you.
So who was Margaret Edwards?
Margaret Alexander Edwards was a librarian for the Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore, and she pioneered teen services. And she's like, teens should be welcome in your library. They should have paper books they're interested in reading. Some of her stuff's outdated because one of the books she recommends that paperback teens would be interested in reading is like Crime and Punishment. But she was like working, I think, like in the 40s and 50s in Baltimore and really kind of revolutionized teen services. And thought, like, you should go to the schools and talk to the teens and let the teens in and welcome them.
So that's really before they were writing books specifically. I mean, targeting books to, I mean, pre-outsiders.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, she's so influential. She actually has two YALSA awards named after her. Because she has the Margaret Edwards Awards, but also the Alex Award for Adult Books with Teen Appeal is named after her because... her name was Margaret Alexander Edwards, and her friends called her Alex. Like, that was her nickname, so, yeah.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. What other awards have you worked on in the past? I know you said you've done the Sibyls many times.
Yes. So, so the Sibyls is an award given by bloggers and other people who talk about books on the internet for fun. And it's, you know, specializes in children's and YA literature, and I have done... the YA Nonfiction Award for 11 or 12 years, I have to do a count, and I've done first-round judging, I've done second-round judging, and for the last 2 years, I've actually been the category chair, which has been really fun in coordinating that, and that's been great. I love the Sibyls. It's a really fun award because it really looks at books that have high literary merit and quality, but also have high reader appeal. So, in trying to find, like, that middle ground between, like, books that are really good, but, like, kids and teens were actually going to want to read and pick up. So that's really fun. I did the YALSA Award for Excellence in Nonfiction for Young Adults, which needs a better name. We called it the Enya. And then just saying a lot of Orinoco flow at each other. So I did that the year that Bomb by Steve Shankin won. And that was great. And then I've also been on the... I was sending books for the College Bound and Lifelong Learners, and that's a book list. It comes out every 5 years. So the list that I worked on is still the most current list if you want to look it up. And it is 100 books, I want to say, in 5 different categories. So 20 books in 5 different categories for 100 books total, or maybe 25 for 120. It's been a few years. And I was lucky enough to be able to chair that committee too and work with that and come up with a list of books that we think would be great for people who want to learn more about the world or are interested in going to college. And we did a lot because we didn't want to define or redefine the canon that's been done. There's a lot of places you can look for, like, what the canon is or what the canon should be, and instead just wanted, you know, a range of books that would kind of open up your mind and just explore new worlds and think of new ways of thinking. So that was a really interesting list and a good list to put together. And that's also a hard list because... any book that's widely available is eligible. It doesn't even have to be in print, as long as it's still widely available. It doesn't have to be in English, as long as it's widely available. It did have to be in English to be on our list, because English was the only language we all read. But technically, if you think about it, you know, the committee can, like, if the committee has the experience to put a non-English language book on there, I think they could. So...
Now that you're doing collection development stuff for the early lit things, would you see yourself moving out of YALSA kind of awards and moving into the more the wanting to work on more younger age awards, or do you still like being involved with YALSA?
I still like being involved with YALSA. Also, at this point, I can't even think about doing an award right now. Like, hopefully, like, I'll be recovered enough, you know, when Sibyls rolls around in the fall. But, like, right now, I'm like, no more awards. So I was finishing up. I was sending books for the College Bound. It would have been 2012, 2013. And I had just, like, stacks of books. So I was sorting, like, yes or no piles in these different categories on my dining room table. And my husband just walked in. And he's like, no. He's like, you cannot do this again for a while. He's like, I can't take it anymore. He's like, you need a break. I need a break.
A little too much.
The stacks of books can get overwhelming quickly when you're just looking at all those books. So
right. Well, and you got two kids at home too, so you'll
be. Yeah, there's also that side of things. So right now I'm, you know, stepping back, and we'll see. I would love to do the Alex Awards sometime with Yelsa. Also, a lot of books. And it'd be interesting to get into ALSC and do some of the award stuff there. They're also, who knows, like, it's a wide open world of award committee stuff, right. So.
I did want to ask real quick of how your conference was going, since we're here at the conference. But other than your award committee, I know we haven't done much more because we're on the Saturday. We have a couple days left, but how has your conference been so far, and what are you looking kind of forward to?
Well, so far it's been great. As always, one of my favorite things about conferences is seeing all of my library internet friends and, you know, the people I talk to online and share ideas and see what's happening, and then actually get to see people in person and get hugs. And so that's been a lot today because it's the first day, so I'm just running into everyone. But I went to a great panel that Image Comics did on romance comics and how romance comics were really popular in the 50s in the post-war period, and then they kind of died off, and looking at one of the reasons they probably died off because back then the happy ending was you would get married and have kids, and they'd only show that one happy ending. But now, with the resurgence in comics and graphic novels and the new popularity, we're seeing different stories told, and such a wider range of stories told. And so we're looking at some of those. And T. Franklin, it was amazing to see her on the panel. I didn't know she was going to be on the panel, and it was great because, like, literally 15 minutes before the panel started, I was telling a friend about how she had to read Bingo Love, which is T. Franklin's book, and how amazing Bingo Love is. And then, like, there she was! And it was great! And then, you know, she was also talking, and then she was talking about how much she loves the work of Alyssa Cole, and if you haven't read any Alyssa Cole's romance novels, like, Alyssa Cole's great. And so it's just a really fun panel, and I'm excited. There's a romance panel tomorrow called Isn't It Romantic with some great authors on it that I'm very excited to see, and I have a few meetings with people I haven't seen in a while to check up, and hopefully I'll be able to hit the exhibit floor. I tried to do it today, but I kept running into people. It was more important to talk to them and catch up with them and seeing how they were. And then I was like, oh, I have to go. Like, oh, no, I have a thing. I RSVP'd too. It's in 10 minutes. I'm a mile away because the convention center is ginormous.
Yeah, I told some of the people earlier that I'm not one of the people that are always lining up at the door, ready to run in to go grab the exclusives and everything. But then on the schedule, I saw that at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning that Raina Telgemeier is doing a signing, and my daughter is just getting into the age where she just loves those books like crazy. She's like, well, I guess I get to be one of those people that goes and stands in lines and runs over to the booths. Because I cannot go home without... I'm coming home with there's an advanced copy of Mo Willems' new series. So I'm bringing that home for my son, and then, because he was an Elephant Piggy huge fan. But then, yeah, I got to go to Raina Telgemeier. Sure.
No, we love Mo Willems. My oldest daughter used to have a pigeon. No, she used to have a hamster named Pigeon. After Mo Willems' Pigeon. But, yeah, so far it's been a great conference. I'm excited for tomorrow and see what else happens, and some interesting stuff on Monday, too. I'm looking forward to the ALSC President's Program on Monday afternoon. And there's some really good speakers there, so.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, and it was great to meet you in person. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of my place of work or the place of work of guests. For past interviews, visit CirculatingIdeas.com and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or review. You can follow the show on Twitter at CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating your ideas. Before when we talked to you, your older daughter was younger, and she was watching Daniel Tiger. And now you have a younger daughter who is now the right age to watch Daniel Tiger. And I was wondering if you could elaborate again on your thoughts on the underlying structure of the world of Daniel Tiger. And if that's changed now that you were away from it for a few years, now you've come back to it. Are you seeing new things in the world?
I still don't understand the economics of the kingdom of make-believe, y'all. Like, I also recently talked about this as an episode of Bellwether Friends on children's TV. And once again, we talked about the economics of Daniel Tiger. I have to say, when my new division chief came in, we at our first staff meeting, he had us play Two Truths and a Lie. And one of my truths was I've been on multiple podcasts talking about the economics of Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. And I was like, it's the podcast. Why do you think it's a lie? Like, we could see you doing it once. I'm like, oh, no. This is a frequent topic of conversation with me. Because they can't afford a swing set and a slide. What kind of monarchy is King Friday running? Like, I understand they're voting, but, dude, if you can't afford both and the kids have to vote, maybe you need some parliamentary representation. Like, how is this? Like, the prince, the oldest prince, Prince Tuesday, has multiple jobs. Like, he babysits for Daniel Tiger. He's a waiter at a restaurant. Like, what are you spending in royal bodyguard protection to let him be a waiter? Because people are not nice to waiters.
Well, as you've said before, I think as you said last time, he's still wearing all of his royal regalia as he's got an apron on.
Yeah, like, what happens if he drops a plate on his royal sash? Like, what are the dry cleaning bills? Like, he's wearing the crown jewels. Like, he's wearing his jeweled crown as he's waiting tables and babysitting a rambunctious preschooler. Like, that just has so many questions.
And if he did poorly, could people leave him a bad tip? Or does he, like, have them jailed or something if they give him a bad review or something?
Yeah, you don't complain on Yelp or you'll end up in the dungeon. I mean, like, what is happening? I will say one of the theories that Anna and Eileen had on Bellwether Friends is they read Prince Tuesday as gay, and they thought maybe he had gotten kicked out of the family, but it was, like, still wearing the crown for extra fabulousness. I don't know. Who knows? Because, like, also, Mommy Tiger has to wear pants. And Daniel Tiger's baby sister, Margaret, also wears pants. Daniel Tiger and Daddy Tiger, no pants. Like, none of the boy tigers have to wear pants, but the girl tigers do. I don't understand.
So there's a little misogyny under there, too. So it's a patriarchy.
I guess. I don't understand, like, the clothing options on animals. I don't understand. They're tigers. Why are they wearing sweaters?
Yeah, I mean, because you can kind of understand sometimes if it's a different kind of animal, different animals might have different ones. But yeah, why would tigers have different between the tigers?
Exactly. The only clothing choice I really understand is the fact that at the opening of every episode, Daniel Tiger zips up his cardigan, because that's a lovely throwback to how Mr. Rogers opened his episodes. I was trying to explain the origins of make-believe to my daughter. I was like, so we used to watch the show called Mr. Rogers, and I'll show you the crayon segment because it's awesome. And Mr. McFeely was like a real person who would come in on his bike and bring cool videos for us to watch. And then the trolley would go into make-believe and it was puppets and live action. And now, like, Daniel Tiger is like, this is all just like make-believe, you know, the next generation. And my daughter's like, what are you even talking about, Mom? Like, you make no sense.
Well, and the puppets on Mr. Rogers were always actually very kind of scary looking, and Daniel Tiger is just like a dirty gray sock kind of thing. And as a kid, it didn't bother me at all, but now I look back, I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah. And Mr. Rogers is like doing half the voices, and you're like, he doesn't actually do very good voices even, but for some reason it worked when you're a kid.
It worked, but, like, I mean, like, Lady Elaine looks like she might eat you. Like she looks like a witch. She, like, if you step on her lawn, you will end up in her, like, witch's stew. But, you know, I do like, though, in the cartoon version, Lady Elaine is much younger. You know, she's a mother of Daniel's friend Miss Elena, which is great. She's married to Music Man Stan, who owns a music store, but she still has that amazing purple eyeshadow. Like, she still has, like, that amazing purple smoky eye for daytime wear. Like, she's still rocking the eyeshadow, so it works.
Like, yeah, well, that's her fashion statement, I guess. At least she's a little more attractive in her younger days. Maybe she has a horrible accent at some point in between those things. I don't know.
It's interesting. I will say, hilariously, this is kind of a random story. So I did my study abroad in China. And in China, a lot of the big cities have their local brand of cigarette. And we were all like, what? Nanjing has their own cigarettes? That's so weird. Like, and we got our teacher to get us a tour to the cigarette factory. So we went on a field trip to the cigarette factory because we thought that would be interesting because we were 20. The cigarette factory tour looks a lot like that crayon factory video. And we were watching it, and I was like, we all kind of looked at each other like, it's the crayon video from Mr. Rogers. Like, we all had the same thought. I'm like, except this is like filter tips instead of like crayons. But like paper, it looked a lot the same, which is very, very weird. And then we went to the tofu factory, and I grew up in Wisconsin, so I've been to the cheese factory tour, like, more times than I can count. So they make tofu the same way they make cheese, except the tofu factory tour starts with them making soy milk out of soybeans. But then they put an enzyme in it, and they stir, and it curdles, and they press it together. And I was like, this is the cheese factory. I assume the enzyme's different, but they don't age it in like a for 2 years. But like, what? This is, I've been on this tour before. Like, it's amazing.
Well, to update our children's programming a little bit, do you have any theories on Peppa Pig or anything else that's a newer show, maybe now as you're getting into as with your newer, younger daughter?
I love Peppa Pig. Peppa is great. All the accent work is spot on. I like how it is realistic without being annoying. It's not overly moralistic or didactic. I like that it's 5 minutes long. I like that almost every episode ends with everyone laughing so hard they fall on the ground and just rolling on the floor laughing, even the adults. My only problem with Peppa is they're always making fun of Daddy Pig for his big round tummy. And like, Daddy Pig needs to lose weight, and Daddy Pig's tummy is too big. Daddy Pig is the exact size and shape as every other adult male on that show.
Yet he is singled out.
Okay. All the other adult males. Because, like, Peppa has a very simple animation style, so it's all basic shapes. Like, it's the exact same oval as all the other grown-up guys. And even if it weren't, you shouldn't fat-shame Daddy Pig.
Right. Even if he was a larger man, that's... Yeah. Don't... Especially, he's your daddy, especially. I mean, you shouldn't ever fat shame somebody, but not your daddy.
I know. But especially if it's like he's the same size as every other dude. Like, the only guys who are smaller than Daddy Pig are five, because they're Peppa's classmates. Like, HBO ruined Sesame Street. Like, luckily they...
I haven't even watched any of the HBO ones.
Oh, like, so luckily they still have, like, the back episodes on, and so we can still watch those. But then especially recently... They do, like, it's now only half an hour long, which, what? And it's 15 minutes of your live-action segment at the beginning, you know, like, in that 123 Sesame Street and Hooper store and on the plaza and everything. And then it's like, oh, what's the letter of the day? And they do the letter of the day. And what's the number of the day? But they don't do any of this stuff to reinforce the number or to reinforce the letter. Like, no, that's the whole point. You do, like, five different things on the letter of the day to reinforce it. You know, it's like, oh, the letter of the day is A, and the number of the day is 15. And that's the show. Like, no, that's useless.
No, you're supposed to have a cartoon about the letter A afterwards and then come back to then do another short segment about A.
And you're supposed to watch the pinball video of 12. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Yep. Exactly. Like, but no, you do a very long song about what's the letter of the day, and it's A, and then there's nothing else. Like, you've stripped all the educational value out of the show. It's still entertaining, and it's still fun, but...
Yeah, when we were watching with our kids, I was not a big fan of Murray, and Murray had a big role for some reason. I don't know.
Murray's great. Okay, but did you...
I liked Murray Had a Little Lamb. So I liked the lamb.
Do you know who sings the Murray Had a Little Lamb thing song?
No.
That is Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Is it?
Yes. I could note it at the time, like when I was watching it with my oldest daughter, like I was like, all right, Murray had a little lamb who wore a little bow everywhere that Murray went. And they would go everywhere, amigos like to go or something. I'm like, it's a cool song, but then I was rewatching it with my younger one. I was like, I know that voice. I know that rhyme style. And I was like, that's Lin-Manuel Miranda, like, doing, like, what? And I'm like, yes, that is.
I had no idea.
It is, like, go back, it is definitely Lin-Manuel Miranda. I was like, oh, what? He's also, on an episode, he tries...
Yeah, I've seen that one.
Where he tries to get Big Bird to move to a new habitat. I was like, he's so young.